Good afternoon. My name is Walt, and this is the Indie Creator Spotlight. I am sorry, but a supervillain infected my blood with nanobots. So if I have a nasally sound to my voice, you can blame them. Today we are talking to Dr. Jason Tondro, aka Dr. Comics, about his time in comics, how Dr. Doom taught him to read the word poltroon, and the supervillain handbook. How are you doing today, sir?
I'm good. It's been a good day, a good week. Thank you. It's good to be here.
Excellent. And for those of you who aren't familiar with you or your work, can you name some of the products that you've worked on so far?
Yeah, absolutely. I've been sort of working in RPGs for about half my life now, doing small things here and there. But over the last several years, I've mostly been writing for Vigilance and Fainting Goat. I did, if you count backwards, the current big project right now is the Supervillain Handbook, which is an archetype book about how to use supervillains in your campaign. We'll talk more about it later, I'm sure. But that's the big project right now. We're on a kickstart for that. We've only got about 5 days left. By the time you hear this, it's probably going to be 4 days left. So we're close to the wire. But we've already met our basic goal, and now we're just pushing for stretch goals. Other than that, I wrote part of Stark City for Icons, Fainting Goat's big shared shared universe superhero setting. I did the Silver District, which was the downtown section of Stark City. I've done The Great Game, which is a cosmic setting for the same universe and the same game system, Icons. The Great Game, cosmic role play in the Stark City universe. I'm the author of Arthur Lives, which is an urban fantasy game using the True 20 game system, the D20 license, of reincarnated Arthurians in the present day, fighting monsters and dodging conspiracies. And I am the author of The Field Guide to Superheroes, which is kind of the superhero twin brother of the good twin, if you will, of the Supervillain Handbook. That came out in four separate volumes from Vigilance Press, still available at DriveThru RPG. And shoot, what else? I did some Mutants and Masterminds projects that I self-published through my imprint, TPK. And that was Escape from Alcatraz. And I did a villains book called Organized Crime. I even did a D20 fantasy, like a D&D version of Shakespeare's Julius Caesar, which I adapted into a D&D adventure, which I know is just like the craziest thing in the world, but there you go.
That's awesome.
Yeah, it's a D20 open license. Yeah, it was a lot of fun. It was great fun to write. And then before that, I worked on Middle Earth Roleplay before that game went under. I wrote some stuff for Hero Games. I designed a whole fantasy setting for Fantasy Hero before Hero Games went under, and Steve Long came in and bought the whole game with his partners, of course. And now we're going back into the Wayback Machine. I even did some stuff for Steve Jackson back in the day. I did some old articles that appeared in Pyramid and Adventurers. I mean, we're talking back into my undergrad days. So yeah, lots of role playing game stuff buried, and I probably missed some things, but that's what I can remember.
And those of us in the know that you're a Georgia a resident. Were you always a Georgia? Were you always a peach, or are you?
No. I'm your Huckleberry. No, I'm from California. I'm a California guy. I grew up in Anaheim. We lived close enough to Disneyland that we could lay on our front lawn and watch the Disneyland fireworks every night over summer.
Oh, that's awesome.
But I Yeah, it was a lot of fun. Really great place to grow up. But I traveled around a lot for school and spent several years out of school, kind of working retail. I ran a video store, which tells all of your listeners how old I am, because those back when those things existed.
Yeah, and, downloaded.
And then I went to grad school. Yeah, exactly. Everything is exactly. Or Redbox if you really want to go out. But I went to grad school at the University of California, Riverside, which is in Southern California. It's about 40 miles inland from LA. And they have a huge comics collection there. They have one of the largest comic collections in the world. It's part of the Eaton Science Fiction Collection, which is the world's largest collection of science fiction, horror, and dystopian fiction. And there's like 70,000 comics in the collection. I mean, that was last time I was told, so it's only gotten bigger since then. So I was able to write my my dissertation on superhero comics, which is kind of my right hand, and my left hand is the classics, Chaucer and Shakespeare and Milton and Beowulf. Milton, the guys I affectionately refer to as the dead white guys. So I do the dead white guys with one hand and comics with the other. And when we did the dissertation, I got to put those two things together. So I got to write about how Jack Kirby's Fourth World can help us better read Ben Jonson's Mask of Queens. Ben Jonson was a Shakespeare contemporary. And I talk about how Spenser's Faerie Queen, which is this massive epic poem that was read to Queen Elizabeth, written for Queen Elizabeth, how that helps us understand Iron Man's Demon in a Bottle plotline. And all of this stuff, how these stories, they're not related, because the people that wrote the people that wrote these books, the people that wrote, for example, Captain America's identity crisis when he lost his uniform and it was given over to the guy who would later go on to become the U.S. agent. Those Steve Englehart, those guys, they had not read much Shakespeare or Ben Jonson or Sidney or Spencer. But my point was that these stories are all romances. And I don't mean romances in the sense of kiss, kiss, love, love romances. I mean in the sense of Arthurian romances. They're adventure stories, and they're heavily symbolic. So you have characters who wear symbols on their chests, and they fight monsters who are allegorical, who are symbolic of their greatest fears or threats to society, whether it be disease or poverty or Russians or, you know, whatever your current boogeyman is. And these characters are very, very similar. And so I got to write about King Arthur and comics and Grant Morrison's Seven Soldiers of Victory and all and his Invisibles and all kinds of other great stuff. The most fun dissertation to write ever. And then after I graduated, that dissertation became my first book, my first sort of academic book, which is called Superheroes of the Round Table, Comics Connections to Medieval and Renaissance Literature. And for any of you who are aspiring academics out there who are potential college professors, the first thing I want to tell you is don't do it. But if you must do it, because that's who you are and you just can't imagine not doing it, the job market for that is really hard. It's really bad. And I was struggling really hard on the job market trying to land a permanent gig until my book came out. And then suddenly I got a couple of interviews. And one of those interviews was for the College of Coastal Georgia, which is the smallest college in the University of Georgia system. And they made me an offer, and I said, damn right, I will take it. And so now I am out teaching comic books for a living. And I had the best gig in the world, you know? So I would have gone anywhere. I would have gone, but I love it out here. Coastal Georgia is beautiful. You know, it's a resort community. This whole place is golf courses and yachting. And it's gorgeous out. It's the same latitude as California. I haven't moved up or down, north or south. I've just moved from west one coast to the other. And in fact, just today, my students all did a big presentation in front of the whole campus about our comics collection, which has been donated to the college, and they created a digital archive for it, and they scanned all the covers and created a wiki for the collection. So every issue has its own web page and with internal scans and plot summary and creator credits. And so we did this whole kind of digital archive of the, of this recent collection. So I, and I got to teach that. I mean, for the last 4 months, I've been creating this digital archive with my students twice a week.
That's impressive. That's gotta be a lot of work.
You know, it was a lot of work, and the students have worked their ass off on it. Absolutely. And we created a little documentary video about it, and we're still not done. We're getting all the issues appraised. So there's a lot of work with local comic book shops. So it's funny. I always get the same response. Whenever I tell people, oh yeah, I teach comics for a living, they always say this. They say, where were you when I was a kid, like going to school? And I'm like, exactly. These classes sell themselves now, but it's surprising. A lot of people don't realize that comics have really become increasingly accepted in academia, and big universities like University of Chicago and University of Florida, and not just liberal strongholds like the UC are teaching comics courses, not only creation of comics, and there's a lot of that too, like at colleges of art and design, like Savannah College of Art and Design or Minneapolis College of Art and Design and so on. There's a lot of places you can go to physically learn sequential art techniques and get a master of fine art in that. But you can also approach comics from the scholarly angle as art history or in terms of literature or in terms of journalism, communications, and you can write serious books and articles on these literatures now. And it's really a great time to be doing what I'm doing. I only get to do it because a bunch of men and women much more distinguished and much longer serving in the field than me paved the way. And so I get to walk on their shoulders and get to the promised land, you know. Yeah, so that's kind of what I do and how I got out here.
And speaking of the promised land, where was your first exposure to comics? I mean, did somebody give it to you as a gift? Did you find it on a spinner rack, comic book shop?
Right. So my very first comic book ever was Marvel Team Up, Spider-Man and Hawkeye versus Quasimodo.
Oh my God.
I think this is kind of like Marvel Team Up number 74 or something like that. I think that's pretty close. Quasimodo was this robot with a hunchback and a laser eyeball, which is how he got apparently named himself after Quasi. I grew up reading Marvel Tales and Spidey Super Stories. I don't know if you remember any of these, but what they would do is you know, any of you have to remember Electric Company. It was a Saturday. It was a children's show that would come on right after Sesame Street, and Spidey would show up on Electric Company, and he would never talk. He would just speak in word balloons, and so you had to learn how to read so that you could understand what Spidey was saying. And these sections were always introduced by this crazy cat named Easy Reader. This is the 70s, and the Easy Reader was a very young Morgan Freeman. This was one of Morgan Freeman's first jobs. And he would come on and say, this comic book is easy to read. Well, so Marvel went back to their old stocks of the earliest Spider-Man comics, and they republished them because this was not difficult vocabulary. And they republished them as specifically books for young readers. And they called them Spidey Super Stories. And they were just reprints of old Marvel, old Spider-Man books. But they would put Morgan Freeman's picture up on the top corner with Easy Reader saying this book was easy to read. And my folks must have bought me a dozen of those things. And I read those and Avengers. I had this great issue where I read a lot of Marvel Team Up because Spidey would team up with other characters from the Marvel Universe. And that was just awesome to me. So that's how I met a lot of these characters for the first time. So I had this great story where Scarlet Witch and the Vision, like time travel back to the Salem Witch Trials and Scarlet Witch gets almost burned at the stake, and that's how I learned about the Salem Witch Trials. You know, I mean, thanks Stan Lee for my corrupted youth, and I had an Avengers story they fight Grim Reaper, like the Grim Reaper shows up and has to decide which one of, whether either the Vision or Wonder Man is going to live or die because they can't both be his brother. Just great stories. That, this amazing Iron Man story, and it's still remembered today. It's an unforgettable Iron Man story. Because it was like a fill-in issue. It was a filler that they had kept in the rack, in their back shelf for the day when the writers and artists team was late. And they pulled it out. It's got no connection. Anything happens before or after. But it's a story where Iron Man remembers his time in Vietnam. And he's going around in Vietnam, and he ends up finding this battlefield site where everybody's dead. And he builds this giant mound over it and writes the word Y on it with his repulsor beams. It's a classic anti-war comic from the Marvel 70s. That was sort of my first exposure to. And then, as parents are wont to do, my dad made me sell my entire comics collection when we moved out of the house. We were moving houses. I think I was, 14 or 15. And I stayed out of comics because I had lost all of my sentimental value until this crazy comic book came out. I was visiting my grandfather one day, and he lived in this little tiny town. It's called El Centro. It's 12 miles north of Mexico. It's in Southern California, right over the border. And I'm in this little tiny town, and I look at the newspaper for this town, and on the cover of the newspaper, there's a picture of a comic book. I'm thinking, what the hell's going on here? Like, what comic book could possibly make it to the cover, to the front page of the El Centro Times or whatever it's called? Well, that comic book was called The Dark Knight Returns. And I followed that comic book to the local comic store, and I bought a copy of Dark Knight Returns, and that's when I fell back down the rabbit hole. And I haven't really looked back up since. I got back into reading, but as an undergraduate, I never thought that I could use my comics as an academic field. I was really a medievalist. I was interested in medieval and Renaissance lit, classical lit. I actually was a history major for a while, and I swapped to English when I got an F on a history test. And then that's kind of how I became the comics guy again. But there was a long period there where I missed out, and I didn't read really any DC before Crisis. Now I've gone back and reread some of it, of course, but that was kind of my exposure.
Was Dark Knight Returns your first exposure to comics that really weren't for children?
Yeah, I think it was. I was reading comics in the Code era, and for those of you that remember the history of the Code, and I have to be academic for a second, the first great book on the Code, and still an absolutely critical one, is Amy Nyberg's book Seal of Approval: The History of the Comics Code in America. And Amy did all of the early research into Frederick Wortham and his study of comics and his research on his book. Now, we've since learned a lot more about Wortham's project, but she did this wonderful book, and it outlines how the Code changed over the decades. In the 70s, the Code was revised. There's this famous incident where the Nixon administration went to Stan Lee and said, "We want you to make a comic book that warns kids away from drugs." I think this is Spider-Man 80. It's in the 80s. I can't remember what number it is, 81, 82. Anyway, we want you to make a comic book that warns kids away from drug use. There was a lot of concern and anxiety over drug abuse and usage in the cities in America at that time. And Stan said, "Well, I'd love to help you, but I can't. The Comics Code does not permit the depiction of any drug paraphernalia at all. I mean, you can't show anybody shooting up. You can't show needles. You can't show somebody high. You can't depict it. It's not allowed." Well, he thought about it for a while, and he realized he had a choice. He could either, I mean, he could do the book, but he'd have to do it without the code approval. Now, most of our listeners won't really know too much about the code, but the code was just a, it was literally retired school teachers decided whether or not a book fulfilled the code or not. Marvel sent all of their books to a committee made up of retired school teachers who would read over the comic and decide what was and was not within the bounds of the code as it was written. And it was established in 1954. Well, then if it qualified, if it fulfilled the code, it would get the stamp on it. And that's how it was enforced. If you were running a drugstore or a newsstand and you got a bunch of comic books, you would only put the ones with the stamp on the rack. If it didn't have the stamp, you would send it back. So the enforcement arm was in the drugstore and the newsstand. Well, so Stan thought, well, I could publish it, but it won't have the seal on it. And you know, we have to give credit where credit is due. He did. He wrote this great comic. And we read it now, and it seems terribly cliched and stereotypical. But it was the first time anybody had ever done a book like that that tried to address a realist social concern, at least something like drugs. Well, anyway, this book led to a rewriting of the code, which allowed a lot of things that had previously not been allowed. And it was during that era that I was reading. So the original code didn't allow things like vampires and werewolves and zombies, and you couldn't have all kinds of things you couldn't have in your book. Well, those were all gone by the time I started to read. So we got Tomb of Dracula and Conan the Barbarian and all kinds of books that you couldn't have previous to that. And both Marvel and DC tried to capitalize on the weakening of the code by creating whole new rafts of titles. So we got all the Barbarian books, and DC tried to answer that with a bunch of attempted answers to Conan, the only one of which stuck was Warlord.
Oh, I loved Warlord.
But they had more luck with their horror. Yeah, what an amazing book. Yeah, Warlord was great. Well, so I was reading during that era, and those books were, they were for kids. They were adolescent comics. There was never anything terribly adult. I mean, you know, Claremont's X-Men was a smart book. It was intelligently written, but it wasn't really, we can't really call it mature or adult, you know. Anyway. But Dark Knight Returns was, I'd never read a comic book like that. I'd never seen a comic book where it was intentionally provocative. I mean, now, it's funny that we should be talking about Dark Knight Returns because I just saw the trailer for Batman versus Superman, which is apparently as close as we're ever going to get to a Dark Knight Returns movie, I think. And the original Dark Knight Returns, it's funny to read it now because Miller's art, I don't know if it's really held up all that well, but we look back at it now, and that book was intentionally trying to push your buttons. I mean, it was trying to be as offensive and out there as anybody had ever seen. You know, it was a provocative book, and he wanted to push what the medium and the form could do. And Frank Miller has since kind of gone off the rails, but I gotta respect his work in that time of his life. And then I started to pick up Watchmen at pretty close to the same time. And I went back to Marvel and I started to read what Marvel was putting out in the mid 80s, 84, 85. And those were some great books, you know. And there's a lot of nostalgia in comics. I think whatever comic book we read when we're kids is always the comics we're always going to like best. And that's we identify with it, and we have a yearning for that time in our lives, and it is the glow of our childhood that makes those comics better than they otherwise would be. It's something unique to comics. Books and films, they don't work that way. I'll read a book today and I'll love it better than anything I ever read when I was a kid. But I read a comic today and I'm like, man, I sure kind of love that Hawkeye versus Quasimodo book, you know?
Absolutely.
So there's a lot of nostalgia. Yeah. There's a lot of nostalgia in these books. So that was, I think. And I was From Dark Knight Returns, you see, I discovered comic book shops, which I had never heard of before, really. And the comic book shop, they didn't care if it had a stamp on it or not. You see, they weren't a newsstand. They weren't a drugstore. They were going to sell it whether it had a stamp or not. And this was the beginning of the end for the Comics Code. And we discovered comic book shops. And for good or ill, I mean, a lot of people will talk about the damage that direct market has done. It's to the industry. But now, thanks to electronic distribution, that hold is finally breaking. So, long answer, but yeah.
Did you happen to hear the announcement today that Frank Miller will be returning to Dark Knight for a third treatment in DC?
You are shitting me.
Nope, it was just announced today. Frank Miller will be returning for a Dark Knight 3. The tentative title is The Master Race.
Well, I have not heard this. If our hangout was broadcasting on April 1, I would be convinced that you were pulling my leg. Because Dark Knight 2... Dark Knight 2 was so successful, right? I mean, has anybody read that book that didn't think it was a giant smoking turd? And moreover, this is very interesting news because, you know, Frank Miller was drawing an airplane smashing into the World Trade Center on 9/11. He was drawing a page from Dark Knight 2, Dark Knight Strikes Back, when the terrorist attack happened, and he's kind of been obsessed with religious culture war with Islam ever since. He wrote and drew Holy Terror, which I expect most of our audience probably knows what Holy Terror is, but if you don't, it started off as a Batman book called Holy Terror Batman, in which Batman would capture and kill Osama bin Laden. And he drew the whole book, and he turned it in, and DC blew their minds and said, okay, we can't print this. Like, You can't make this a Batman book. This is fucking insane. And so they said, no, you can't do it. And so he published it on his own, but he just rebranded the character, so it's not Batman and Catwoman in it anymore. It's the Fixer, and I forget what the girl's name is. And he just went through and he changed the art a little bit, and he chopped off the girl's ears most of the time. There's more than one panel in Holy Terror where you can still see Catwoman's ears on the female figure. Anyway, he made minor changes to the art and then published it as a new book called Holy Terror. And his defense, and it's a very interesting defense historically, is this book is propaganda. It's propaganda for a war. And that is not unusual for comic books. Jim Steranko, in his two-volume history of comic books in America, said that Captain America is what gave comics a reason to exist. And what he's talking about is that first issue of Captain America when he is punching Hitler in the face. This was happening in April of 1941, before we had gone to war. That is, Captain America made comic books into propaganda. They were not entertainment anymore. They had a purpose, and that purpose was going into and winning World War II. And they were no longer just cheap entertainment. They had a kind of social function. And Miller's defense for Holy Terror is that he is fulfilling and continuing that social function. Well, okay, but in the process, he's also characterized the entire religion of Islam and the entire Arab culture as a, demonized inhuman monsters. And it's morally repulsive. And yet, it's some of the best art he's ever done. It's such a problem, that book, because it's so beautiful to look at and so awful to read.
That's tough when you have a favorite like that that does something that... one of the good sides of that is it forces conversation. It forces...
Oh, yeah.
And that's something where comics is really reaching more young people than straight up literature, and forcing conversations, these tough issues, especially with things like Marvel and DC are doing now, where they're pushing issues of diversity and stuff. But you had mentioned Osama bin Laden. You've mentioned Hitler.
Yeah.
In discussing some of these titles, do you think comics really, with their supervillains and you know, rogues galleries and stuff like that, do you really think that comics are a way for us to battle our demons in a way that's healthy and helps other people?
There's an author named Bruno Bettelheim who's written this wonderful book called The Uses of Enchantment. And what he's writing about is fairy tales, but it's the same argument for comic books. Comic books and fairy tales are, you know, we have a desire in the Disney era to sanitize fairy tales and to make them all kind of happy endings where the bad guy in a Disney movie never gets killed by the hero. He always falls off a cliff and dies, you know, like it's random chance or the hand of fate that arranges death. Like nobody's ever responsible for killing the bad guy. And Bettelheim argues that there's a reason for these fairy tales to be dark, that our favorite fairy tales are dark. And that's because they give us a chance to be exposed to threats in a safe way that we know we're going to be able to get out of. We read about these characters and they go through great struggles, but in the end, Little Red Riding Hood is cut out of the wolf's belly by the lumberjack, by the woodsman, and she's rescued, you know, and it's awful that she gets eaten and swallowed up, and it's gruesome that she is cut out of the wolf's belly, but ultimately the ending is a positive. And I think that superhero comics work in this very, very similar way. And you know, these villains, these nemeses, these archenemies that we face, like the Joker, for example, just to pick one. I mean, madness and insanity and psychoses, mental instability is something that a lot of us are afraid of, or maybe have had contact with, or that we dread. I mean, every one of us has had that moment where we kind of feel like we're going a little crazy. and encountering these characters and seeing that craziness overcome and put in a confined space and locked away, not forever, because we can never completely overcome our demons, but becomes a way for us to work through these anxieties in a personally and socially constructive and positive way. Now, it's not always good. You know, sometimes we have a habit, especially in comics, of stereotyping, especially race and culture and foreigners. You know, so when we introduce somebody like Ra's al Ghul, for example, you know, it's very easy for Ra's to get kind of stereotyped as the evil Arab or the evil Asian or some kind of Asian mastermind in the Fu Manchu mode, you know. Characters like the Mandarin and the Yellow Claw are great examples of this. I remember one time reading Kurt Busiek trying to defend the Yellow Claw and saying the Yellow Claw is not racist. He's not a racist stereotype because, you know, he's yellow. He's called the Yellow Claw because his skin is yellow. And I'm like, yeah, but why is his skin yellow? Because he's Asian. I mean, if he wasn't Asian, he wouldn't be the Yellow Claw. And so we have a long history in superhero comics of kind of pandering to the lowest common denominator, kind of pulling the low-hanging fruit. Now, we haven't always done this. As I tell my students in class, I assign All-Star Superman, for example, virtually every semester in one of my classes. There's 99 terrible comics out there for every one that's a jewel, but we're not reading the 99 ones that are crappy. We're just reading the jewels. And that's true of novels and films and television. I mean, we all know that there's 100,000 channels and nothing on, you know? It seems like we all want to talk about the same really, really good ones. And that's true with comics. So yeah, when it's done right, they absolutely can be a way for us to grapple with, I think, real social issues and concerns and anxieties. And they'll give us a great glimpse into particular historical moments as well. So we can see communist threat in early Iron Man, where virtually every bad guy he fought was a communist or was a member of Tony Stark's own company who had stolen industrial secrets and used them to become a supervillain, or both. He was A, B, or A plus B. And what you see here is a lot of concern over communism, but you also see a lot of celebration of the entrepreneur technologist, you know, the kind of Howard Hughes hero who's rich and a genius and uses his science to solve all of mankind's problems. This is the same kind of character that 50 years later we would turn over in the form of characters like Dan Draper, you know, who's a member of the corporate world and yet incredibly fragile and has feet of clay and they become human and kind of sad. As the decades go by, these characters lose their original meaning and they gain historical value to help us understand the time periods in which they were made. If that makes any sense.
Oh, absolutely. And leading into that, do you, with your original work of The Field Guide to Superheroes was a really in-depth look in how heroes are treated and how they apply in a story. Do you think that these dark themes in comics and our love affair with dark themes in comics drove you to write the Supervillain Handbook, or did you see it as a natural progression out of your earlier work?
Yeah, that's a great question. So I'll tell you a little bit of story about how the Supervillain Handbook came about and how it relates to the Field Guide to Superheroes. There's a curious thing that happens in writing for superhero role-playing games. We all want to write up heroes. We want to populate the universe. We want to create a new setting, and we want to fill it with heroes. On the other hand, that's the least useful thing to a GM because the player characters are the heroes. What the GM really needs is bad guys. I wrote the Field Guide like 10 years ago and at the time there was a bunch of archetype books coming out. Lewis Porter was doing like an archetype book every week, it seemed like. And there were a bunch of archetypes in the Mutants and Masterminds rule books. And there were just everybody was talking about superhero archetypes. And what I wanted to do was do it a little bit differently because, and I believe, and I could be wrong on this, but I believe that the idea of the gaming sense of superhero archetypes in terms of the strong guy and the fast guy and the energy projector and the mentalist and the martial artist, I believe that all goes back to Champions, which was the first superhero game to really call them that. You had the brick and the blaster and the speedster and the martial artist and the mentalist and the energy projector and so on. And they really sort of classified these. Champions was an open-ended point-based system, so you could give your character any powers that you wanted. But it was also a complicated system, and it was often easier to think in terms of a class. Like, okay, if I was playing in a class-based game, what would be my class? And you created characters that fit into these sort of established power sets. Well, this continued into M&M when you would have characters. And if you remember Mutants and Masterminds, from the very first edition, it had 6 or 8 pages of archetypes in the beginning of the book where you would just pick one. They were all pre-made characters. And you would just pick one and play it. And they had like the Weapon Master and the Animal Totem and the Energy, the Elemental Controller and so on. Well, that's all great for helping you figure out the mechanics of your powers. That's what that's for, is to streamline the character creation process in a game that has a lot of fiddly bits and fine grain. But what it doesn't do really well is, quite frankly, get to what I think is the important part about these characters, which isn't their powers. I mean, let's talk about the fire guy. I mean, is your fire guy like a kid who suddenly develops fire powers and really just wants to use them to pick up chicks and drive race cars like Johnny Storm, the Second Human Torch? Or is he an android, artificial organism whose body combusts upon being exposed to air? And so he's forever alienated from other human beings, not only because they can't understand him because he's a robot, but because he bursts into flame when he's exposed to air, like the original Human Torch. Or is he a burning character like the Ghost Rider, whose head is on fire and who shoots hellbolt? I'm talking about the original Ghost Rider, the Johnny Blaze. I mean, his name is Johnny Blaze, for Christ's sake, right? So all of these characters are basically elemental dudes. They're all basically fire dudes. But they could not be more different in terms of the personalities and the stories that they're used to tell. In M&M, they all have blast, energy blast, fire blast, 10 or whatever. But they don't, but they're story-wise, they're completely different. And so that's how my archetype book was structured, was by, so we talk about the alien and the android hero and the kid and the occult hero, for example, and so on. This kind of Hellboy character who's a demonic monster but trying to use his powers for good, and so on. And I had 40 of them. And we broke it up into 4 separate books and published them 10 at a time. That was the only way that we could do it back then. And I loved doing it. And I created the setting for it, which I called the Worlds of Wonder, was the setting. And I really loved that setting and I loved making it. But I had to admit at the time I was done that it was not the most useful thing I could have written. What I really should have written was a villain book. That's what GMs need. They need villain. Now it's good for players. It's good for players, and I've used it when I ran superhero games. I would give people the field guide, and I would say, just flip through here and look for ideas to kind of help you figure out what kind of character you might want to make. But that's not the most useful thing. Here, players can think up their own heroes, and they don't like to be shown pre-made characters. Most players don't like pre-made characters. The whole point of role-playing is to make your own idea. But a GM needs villains. Every week he needs villains. And he can't just use the same ones every time, unless you're playing the X-Men comic where Magneto shows up in every single issue for the first year and a half. Unless you're doing that story, you need a lot of villains. And so as soon as the field guide was over, I knew that like the smart thing for me to do was to make a villain version. But there was a lot of projects going on at the time, and Vigilance had a lot of stuff going on. They had a big product line, and you know, there's just not enough time in the day and not enough kind of oxygen in the air for everything to come out at the same time. And we also weren't really entirely sure what system we wanted to use it in, because we'd actually done the field guide to superheroes for Icons. But I kind of preferred Mutants and Masterminds for the grain. I kind of liked the more detail of M&M. And so we were kind of batting that idea back and forth, and it never happened. And then Mike came in at Fainting Goat, and you know, God bless Mike Lafferty. But I had written the the Stark City and the Great Game for him. And he said, well, what do you want to write, Jason? Because, like, basically, I'll publish whatever you want to write. And I said, well, it seems to me like the smart thing to do is this villain book. And we knew that the Icons Assembled Edition was coming out. And that was kind of my impetus for thinking about the villain book, was because we knew that we had a revised edition of the Icons book coming out, and they were going to need villains for it. And so I thought, well, let's do that. And Steve Kenson was totally on board with that. He thought it was a great idea. And so that's kind of how the Supervillain Handbook originated. And Mike was all for making it one great big fat book instead of four separate ones, which I think is cool. I knew that it was going to be really expensive because 40 archetypes means at least 40 pieces of art. You got to illustrate every archetype. And that would make it a very expensive book. And Mike paid most of the art costs up front out of his own pocket. And then we did the Kickstarter to kind of reimburse him, which is just amazing. That's wonderful. And then I came to the decision about putting these villains into context. I can just invent 40 villains that are self-contained and don't relate to anything, and they're all kind of self-contained, little living in their own bubbles. But let's be honest, that's not as interesting as it could be. There's a lot more potential for story, and it's just more fun to read if they're connected to a kind of larger setting where they interact with each other and maybe with heroes, and there's some kind of sense of context for these characters. If they don't have any context, then they don't really have much weight. This is a mystery that Busek realized when he was writing Astro City. So he would write an Astro City book, and on every page you'd meet some new superhero, but they'd always be talking as if they'd been around for 40 years. They would refer to stories and other events that had happened in decades past, and we never got to actually read those stories, but we knew they were there. And that gave the whole setting this kind of gravitas that made us feel like we knew them, even though we had actually just met them. This is a secret to successful superheroes in my book, as I see it. Anyway, so I knew we have to have some kind of setting for these characters, and I had to figure out what setting would that be. Well, I didn't own Worlds of Wonder anymore. I mean, I don't know if I really do or not. We did it for Vigilance, and it was part of the Field Guide to Superheroes, and I didn't want to go back there and revisit that. I really wanted to do something new. Several years had passed, and even though I had created the Worlds of Wonder to be my definitive superhero setting, definitive only lasts until you get the next great idea, you know? And so I thought, well, let's do something new. Let's do something fresh. And I had learned from the Field Guide, because when I had created the Field Guide characters, and there's 40 archetypes, but there's also 40 heroes in that book. It's a long discussion of each archetype plus a fully created hero that demonstrates that archetype. When I created those characters, I'm very proud of them and I like them and they're very interesting. But visually, their visual design is not always very imaginative. This was 10 years ago in the early 2000s, and I kind of had a tendency to run home. My home base was sort of the trench coat crowd, like the non-costume, like the guy that goes around and fights crime and saves the world wearing a black trench coat and sneakers, you know, like that kind of anti-hero. Not dark, because I'm not really a big fan of dark and gritty. I think that's kind of been overdone a bit much, but kind of realistic, you know, characters that you could recognize. And so... I really noticed as I was telling Dan Houser to the art, this is back when Dan was basically illustrating the entire Icons line. Like, no matter what company was publishing your Icons book, Dan did the art. He was the man. He was the Icons dude. And it was great to work with him because his art just really matured over the course of this book. Because it took a while for all four books to come out. And you look at his art in the first few pages, and you look at his art in the last two pages, and it's just great to see his talent really just flourish. Well, anyway. And I really got tired of telling Dan, okay, this is a guy in a trench coat, right? And I started to embarrass every time I would write up yet another guy in a trench coat, you know? And so I realized, and he would, at the same time that I was doing that, Dan was creating all these great new visual ideas, because he would do two art pieces for each archetype. one for the character I had created and one that was just sort of his own idea of that version of the archetype. And all of his were so much more cooler than mine. I was so jealous. Like his character ideas were visually exciting and they were so fun. He did this guy called Fastlane who was like the speedster. But of course, I don't have a speedster archetype because that's a power and I'm not really interested in fighting people by their powers. He was an example of the defender archetype, the guy who picks the superhero who has like a particular place or ethnicity or cause that he defends over any other. And so Fastlane was the defender of America's highways. Like he ran across America on the interstate highway, stopping crime. And his suit is like highway, like granite black, like the color of a highway with this yellow dashed line down the center. It is genius. And I could write that guy for 66 issues. I want to write Fastlane forever, you know? And so that's when I realized that I would, this book would be so much better if I let the artist come up with the visual design for the character, and then I would create a character background to suit it. So that's what we did. And so that brought Jacob Blackman and Joe Singleton and Joe Arnold and our other artists, Dionysia Jones, she did a couple for us. And they had these ideas of their own that fit each archetype. And I was like, yeah, okay. And I might tweak it a little bit. Like I remember Jacob's first version of our doppelganger, you know, the supervillain who steals your appearance. His first version was like a guy. We knew we were going to name him Rakshasa after the Indian shapeshifter tigers that, you know, D&D made famous. We knew we were going to name him Rakshasa, and his first version of Rakshasa was kind of a guy, basically a humanoid with a tiger head. And I was like, well, can we make that kind of more monstrous? Like, can he be like just more of a creepy, strange, bizarre creature that steals your skin and like crawls around inside of your skin? And so he redid Rakshasa and he made this awesome, and it looks so great. And so we would collaborate a little bit on those concepts. But I learned a lot from the field guide. So the Supervillain Handbook is A, quite frankly, a much better book, I think, because the artists had a lot more influence on the visual design of the characters. And secondly, it's much more useful, because it's a book full of 40 villains, or at least it will be by the time we're done with it. Right now, it's mostly archetype discussion, so it's a lot of story and plot advice for the GM. Now, there are stat blocks in there. Icon stat blocks can fit on a 3x5 card. You know, they're really simple. And there are stat blocks in there, one for every archetype, but there's not fully developed villains in there. That'll come with the deluxe edition, and we have hit that goal. So that's totally going to be in the book now. Now I got a bunch of writing for myself to do all summer. So we're going to write the 40 new supervillains made to fit the art that the artists have already given us. And we'll write them up in icons, but we've also cleared some other game systems. We hit supers. That was one of the first ones to clear. Brandon Blackmore wants to do a Bulletproof Blues version. We've got Russ Payton?
Yeah, it's Ross. Yep, Russ Payton.
Ross Payton doing a fate conversion of the basic guide. We haven't hit the goal yet where he goes back and does a fate version of all of the 40 villains that's coming out in the deluxe edition.
But it's close. We're getting there as of this afternoon.
We're very close. Savage Worlds, I want to write because I really have a lot of respect for the Savage Worlds. What's it called? It's not Necessary Evil. The Necessary Evil setting. The whole idea of playing villains, I think players really respond to that. And this book would be great for them, you know, like all of these different villain ideas. I get to combine. Like not only do you give the GM what he needs with a book full of villains, you also give players a giant book full of character creation advice because they are the villains. So that book kind of serves double duty in that setting. And then there's an M&M version. We got, I think Aid has agreed to write our M&M conversion, which we haven't hit yet, but which I'm hoping that we do. But I'll tell you, since we're on the topic of conversions, and I'm sorry, I just keep sort of railroading over your outline here, but I'm kind of from an old school RPG mentality where books that were conversions, books that gave you multiple systems for the same product, those were really rare. Like I can count them on the one hand. Like there was an M&M Champions crossover back in the day, and there was a Silver Age Sentinels Champions crossover. But these books were really rare. Mostly what we all did, this is what being a GM is all about, you know. You buy a villain book for another system, then you convert the villains to your own system. So I bought every single villain's book DC Heroes put out, man. I never ran DC Heroes. I converted them all over to Champions or whatever game system I was running at the time. And so that's actually very easy to do with this book because most of it is story advice. There's a section on abilities, like what can that archetype usually do? A section on qualities, which for those of you that know icons are kind of like fate taglines. They're phrases that describe what the character can do. And so you might give them a famous tagline like World's Greatest Detective or The Dark Knight or, you know, something like that. And then, so the quality sort of describes how they do what they do. And there's a lot of examples from comics and film and television. And then, like, the bulk of it is stories. Like, what stories do you use that villain to tell? So if you're doing the girlfriend gone bad archetype, which is about how the hero has to choose between love and being a hero, or how the damage that his hero-ness does to the close ones, the people that are close to him, so that somebody like Star Sapphire, who was a perfectly nice person before she became Star Sapphire, gets caught up in Hal Jordan's world and gets turned to evil. And, you know, and now, of course, she's a lantern and everything. But in the girlfriend gone bad idea, she was not. She was just a villain. So when you're playing with these archetypes, you know, what stories do they tell? And whether it's the wolf in sheep's clothing, which is the villain that's pretending to be a hero, or the cosmic menace, somebody like Galactus, which is not really there to be fought. Like, I mean, everyone remembers that great John Byrne story where everybody teamed up and punched Galactus. But other than that one story, Galactus is kind of designed to be unpunchable. That's sort of the point. What is that story for? Or the imp, like the character like Mixis Pitalik or the Beyonder, who shows up and sort of wacky hijinks ensue, and the heroes have to run around playing super babysitter. What are all of those stories? Is your character a supremacist, where he's a villain that wants to make the world safe for his own kind, like Magneto in many of his most famous versions? Or is he an ex-con? Is he a, I want to call him an ex-con, but that's actually a heroic archetype. A fallen hero, a guy like Hal Jordan or somebody like Hal Jordan and Phoenix are really power corrupted. They're examples of heroes who are given too much power. And there's a moral in here about how much power heroes should have and how much is too much. And one of those morals is that apparently that limit is higher if you're male than if you're female. Like, female heroes are more likely to become power corrupted than male heroes. Until Hal Jordan, there was almost no male heroes that were corrupted by their power. It was kind of all the burn victims, you know, like all of them in a row. And there was Dark Phoenix and Dark Scarlet Witch and Dark Invisible Girl. Like, pretty much every hero that John Byrne worked on got too much power and turned evil. And then Hal Jordan came along and made it okay for men to be corrupted by their own power too. So all of these stories and it's all that stuff is system neutral. Like, it doesn't matter what game system you're doing. That stuff is system neutral. And then Icons is such a simple game system that you can read it and kind of realize what we're talking about. I mean, so power corrupted needs to have a lot of power. Like, they need to have numbers that are basically off the scale, whatever scale you're using. dial it up to 11, and that's what the Power Corrupted has, whether you're talking about M&M or Hero or Savage Worlds or Fate or whatever. So that's all very easy to convert on your own. So even if we don't hit these goals, the book is super useful. And if you don't believe me, you can buy it for $1. You can get the text of this book with no art, no layout, just the raw text. You can get the raw text on this book for $1 on the Kickstarter. And then once you read it and you see that it's system neutral, then you can up your pledge to, you know, get the PDF or get the hard copy or help, you know, pay for whatever else you feel like paying for graciously. Boy, I have like talked for an hour.
It's totally cool. I mean, that's the whole point. You know, we want to hear what you have to say about these things. I just have a couple more questions, and
yeah, sure.
You've been super gracious with your time. So I just wanted to point out when we were talking about Fastlane. You had said that you could write that guy for 66 issues. Is that is that in reference to Route 66? Is that what that?
Well, of course. I mean, of course. I would. If I was writing Fastlane, and God, somebody out there, if you're an artist, please come to me so that we can draw the Fastlane comic together. Because in the top corner, every issue would be a highway sign, right? So
yep.
The number on this issue would be the highway that we're on, right? And it would be all across America. It would be like the most patriotic speedster comic you've ever read. It would be awesome.
That's fantastic. But I'll help you out with it if you agree to put Smokey and the Bandit in it for at least one issue.
Guaranteed.
Excellent. I gotta ask. My other question is, when you go on to design the 40 archetypes, how many of you have you thought of are going to require a trench coat?
See, like so hopefully none. Like because the artists are all smart, right? The artists don't want to draw another dude in a trench coat or ordinary clothes. They have all these great, wonderfully exciting images. And so I think it's great. And so we've created this new setting, which isn't the Worlds of Wonder, which is a new setting, the public domain setting. We've talked about this a little bit already on podcasts, and it's described a little bit in the pitch for the book. But we wanted, I asked Mike this idea. I'm like, well, you got a lot of these villain archetypes that only make sense if you understand the hero that they fight. The obvious example is things like the Dark Mirror, who's got all of the hero's powers, but he uses those powers for evil. The original Venom, for example, or Carnage, characters which are basically Spider-Man's power set, but they're crazy people and they use their powers for evil. Now Venom's a whole other character. And thank you, by the way, those of you that listen to our other podcasts know that Walt cued me into the Flash Thompson Venom. And no sooner did he do that than one of my students in class brought it up, and because he's a veteran, and he was talking about this book, and I was able to talk about this book like I knew what I was saying, and it's all Walt's fault. So thank you, Walt.
Yes, sir.
Right, he's there for me. He's like my wingman. Okay, so, the girlfriend gone bad is another version. A villain that only makes sense if you know, right? So I knew that we would have to talk about some heroes in order for the villains to make sense. Not all of them, but there's several. And some of them are even, you got the fallen hero, for example, archetype, who was a hero. Or heroes like, or villains like the Vigilante, which is just a dark Avenger of the night that's gone too far. Somebody like the Red Hood.
Or the Punisher.
Yeah. I mean, when the Punisher first appeared, he was a Spider-Man villain. He was a vigilante. He was a riff on the Executioner, you know, the Mac Bolan Executioner books. And now, of course, he's just considered a hero, and no one bats an eye at the fact that he carries around an arsenal. But in the 70s, that was a bad guy thing. So So I knew that we were going to have heroes. Well, so here's my thought process. Okay, so if we're going to have heroes in a book, who are they going to be? I don't want to invent more heroes because I learned from the field guide that that's kind of a foolish thing to do. I think that we want to do it because we have fun making heroes, but heroes aren't very useful. And also, I wanted to avoid the other choice that a lot of people would do in this situation is just kind of talk about generic heroes like Paragon or Night Avenger and Power Princess Woman. You know, like we would make nods towards Superman, Batman, Wonder Woman, Captain America, Spider-Man, Thor. We would never call them that, except Thor. You can totally call Thor Thor because you can't trademark a myth. We would not name them, but we would be making kind of gestures towards them and everyone would know who we were talking about. Well, that's easy, but it's boring. There's no challenge in that. So I got this idea that maybe we would use public domain heroes, which has been done before. I'm talking about Operation Superpowers, for example, or the Protectors was another attempt at doing this. And let's just do that. Let's bring back these public domain heroes and do 21st century reboots of them. Not the same characters. It's not literally the Amazing Man who's still alive since 1940. It's more like what happened to Green Lantern when there was an original Green Lantern, and then in the 60s, they came back and they came up with a new Green Lantern who had the same name and vaguely the same power set, but otherwise totally different. What if we did that with these heroes? Same name, same kind of idea, but kind of riff on it and make it more modern. And then from there, I had the big leap where I asked Mike, hey, if all of our heroes are public domain, can we make the villains all public domain too? Like, can we put, not their game stats, because that's all bound by license, but if we put the background and the concept and the art and their name all in public domain, can we do that? Of course, this is a big deal for Mike because he's the one buying all the art. I mean, he's the one that's basically giving all that shit to public domain. And again, God bless Mike Lafferty. And he said, yeah, sure. Why not? I mean, we're never, why not? So thus the universe was born, the YO universe, you know, the idea of a public domain setting, which is now regardless of game system or publisher house. So if somebody out there decides that they want to write characters in the universe, and they probably won't because everybody wants to make their own universe. But if 10 years or 20 years or 30 years from now, I want to make another character in the universe, I can, because all those characters will be public domain and the setting is still there and it doesn't care about a game system or a company or whatever.
And you know, the great thing about that is
we make it interesting.
I'm sorry, sir. I was going to say the great thing about that several of the people who have donated graciously to the Kickstarter are actually guys who are doing their own independent comics. And they're not role-playing gamers, but they saw things like Joe Singleton's rendition of Nightbird and have said that...
Yeah, which is great. Isn't he awesome?
Oh, my God. And it's so much different than the original. I mean, you see the original and he looks so scrawny and, like Captain America before the treatment.
Yeah.
And you see the current rendition, Joe's rendition, and he looks like a bruiser. And some of these comic book artists and creators who have bought into the Supervillain Handbook just for the archetype descriptions. One guy even said it's a master's, and I'm quoting, it's a master's class on villainology in a book. So I thought that was kind of neat. But
oh, that's very kind.
Yeah, they're going to use these archetypes for their stories much more than on a game table. And I know one in particular has said Nightbird in that rendition, Joe's rendition, will be showing up in his comic.
Well, that's all. That's great. God, congratulations, Joe. That's and well deserved too, because Joe's work was great. Joe created one of the nice things about the artists and their influence here is that I was able to say, okay, you pick what hero you want to create. Joe came into the project near the end, and a lot of the archetypes had already been drawn. And the ones that hadn't been drawn are the ones that required hero research. Like, that's always more work, and so people didn't get to those yet. So the ones that were left were like the evil twin and the dark mirror and the fallen hero and the vigilante, all the ones that required hero research on publicdomainsuperheroes.com. And so I said, well, Joe, you know, you pick like what heroes do you want to do? And I think he did Hugo Danner too. Did he do the Hugo Danner picks?
Yep.
Yeah. And Joe's a big Hugo Danner fan. Like that was like the very first thing he asked me. He was like, well, do you have Hugo Danner in your setting? And I'm like, not yet, but now we do. I asked him, well, can that be like my version of the Marvel family? Like instead of having a family of related Marvel, Captain Marvel heroes, can we do the Danner family? And of course, the important thing about this is that if you remember Gladiator, those of you that have read it, Hugo Danner specifically cannot have kids. He's infertile. And so the idea of having a family becomes a major plot element. Like he has to find a way to have kids. And then he does. And we get this whole kind of family of his offspring. And he goes off and becomes the reclusive hermit that wanders the world having adventures nobody ever hears about. And his kids become heroes and villains because one of them is the fallen hero, is the evil, the Hugo Danner black sheep, the one of the black sheep in the family who goes bad. And he picked Nightbird because he had to do an evil twin, which is different than the Dark Mirror. The Dark Mirror is another guy who has your powers and uses them for evil. The evil twin is you from another dimension or an alternate timeline. Like Owlman or Ultraman, and all those other characters from Earth 2 or Earth 3, depending on when you read those books. and so he made up Nightbird so that he could make the evil twin of Nightbird, who's got like this owl thing going on. Like the bird face has been turned to an owl face by the addition of sweat shoulder pieces that mimic the ears of the owl and the eyes and the beak. And it's a totally great, like sort of owl chest plate. So he just did a wonderful job. And Dionysia did the same thing with the woman in red. She went back and was looking for characters, and she saw the woman in red. Cause I asked her, I said, well, maybe we could do one of those girl detective characters, of which there were so many in the 1930s, 1940s, that were basically a woman in an evening gown wearing a domino mask, carrying a pistol and fighting crime, solving crimes, and like the sort of girl detective, always in heels, always in a slinky evening dress, and always with long hair. And yeah, we wanted to get a lot of people. Yeah, totally. I mean, God, as you would do, yes. and we wanted to spread out the ethnic and the race and the gender issues, and we wanted to make it as a diverse a book as possible. So she took the woman in red and made her this sort of plucky African-American detective, and we took away the gun and gave her a flashlight and made her kind of a problem solver. She's much more of a detective and less of a violent. So that became the Dark Mirror. The Dark Mirror is Scarlet, who's kind of the two pistol, shoot 'em up version of the woman in red. And it's just really come out really neat. And watching the artists pick their favorite characters and play around with them, like Wolf Savage. I think Joe Arnold did Wolf Savage, and I had no idea who Wolf Savage is. He appeared once in a Canadian magazine. It was a text story with like three pictures in it. And Wolf Savage is this guy who's got two pet wolves, and he flies, and he has a sword that shoots a laser beam out of it. I mean, he is just like all over the place. And we got this new version of Wolf Savage, and he's uh, he's the fallen hero, I think, because he's killed, you know, and he's kind of given into the beast. But, you know, he's our little Canadian in the mix. So it's been a really interesting, I don't think any of them are like, no, okay, you know what? There is a guy in a trench coat. It's not my fault. For one of the master, like the mastermind or something, like one of or the conqueror, Joe wanted to do Robur the Conqueror, who is the villain in one of Jules Verne's novels. He has a flying machine called the Albatross. It's a heavier than air flying machine that's, believe it or not, made of paper. That's been chemically treated to be as strong as steel. And so he wanted to do Robur the Conqueror. And I'm like, well, you know, I mean, he's already public domain. He's a Victorian era character. Yeah, sure, let's do him. And then he drew him, and Robur is sort of this French dilettante. I think he's got like this long coat. It's not a trench coat. It's more like a almost like a tuxedo jacket kind of long coat on. So if there are any trench coats, I take no responsibility for them.
And we have, as of the time of this recording, we're working on 4 days left of the Kickstarter. We are closing in on the deluxe edition of the Fate core rules.
Which I can't wait to, because I love Fate so much. It's such a great game system.
Yeah, absolutely. And we've actually played a version of it on the BAM podcast, working with Ross, debuting his Base Raiders game, which is a great
Base Raiders.
Yeah, great game, a lot of fun, interesting setting. So, and I think that people, even in Base Raiders, will get a lot of use out of the Supervillain Handbook if they were to pick it up as well. If you had to pick one archetype out of your Supervillain Handbook that you feel speaks to you the most, which one do you think it would be?
Speaks to me the most. Gosh, this is a hard one.
Yeah, like, which one do you feel like when you open it, you know, once you get that physical copy, you know that this is the one that's going to be dog-eared the most, and it's the one that the book will fall open to when you put it on.
You know, it's funny because I'm an old school Conqueror fan. I mean, like, Dr. Doom is the man as far as I'm concerned. I mean, like, the guy who who wants to take over the world for its own, you know. But as much as I love the Conqueror was not hard to write. I mean, the Conqueror's stories are pretty straightforward, and although there's a lot of variation in them, and there's many examples of the Conqueror from fiction. The archetypes that I worked the hardest on are the ones that are burdened by difficult politics of gender and race. So, for example, writing the foreigner archetype was a real challenge, and the temptress was another real challenging one. You know, the temptress is like the poison ivy kind of archetype. Like, the character, always a female who persuades the hero to do bad things by tempting him with sex. And it's just, it's so problematic, you know. And I hate to use that word because we overuse it a lot in academia. But, you know, it's just a really loaded archetype. Like, you present these sort of horror characters, you know, who are all evil and wicked women. And it's an outgrowth of the femme fatale, really. It's a femme fatale updated for the superheroes. So it's a femme fatale in tights, or sometimes not even tights, depending on how sexy the character is. and characters like the temptress and the foreigner, which we already talked about earlier in the podcast, you know, characters like Roz or the Mandarin, or the Yellow Claw, or all the communist villains from the Marvel Age, like Crimson Dynamo or the Gremlin or, you know, all of those crazy guys. Black villains like Bushmaster, you know, just like characters which now you look back on them now and you think, man, that's really offensive. Like, that's just really offensive. And I know that whenever we start talking about this, a lot of sort of PC police kind of come out and say, oh, well, you don't have to worry about being PC. Politically correct is a big trap. Don't worry about that. But, you know, we could have ignored those archetypes. We could have just ignored them and left them out, which would have been the overreaction. That would have been the PC thing to do, would be to just leave them out. We could have just included them and not talked about how problematic they are. Like, I could have just given you another sex bomb, femme fatale, and another evil African, and not said anything about it, and just let it sit there as a big, ugly stereotype. Or we could do what I think was the hardest thing, as I frequently tell my students in writing class, whenever they don't know what to do, whenever you don't know what to do on a writing assignment, ask yourself what is hard, and then do that. Because chances are that's the right thing to do. So we've got long conversations about the problems of depicting women in superhero comics who are these sort of sex bomb temptress villains, or depictions of foreigners from other countries who are here to corrupt America, or who are the worst stereotypes of their region. And we sort of face it head on, and then we talk about how great comics writers since then have rehabilitated those characters and made them more interesting, so that Poison Ivy isn't just a sex bomb anymore. Now she's an environmentalist, you know, and she doesn't seduce men because she's using sex. She's using men because she kind of hates them. She kind of dislikes all human beings are kind of inferior to plant life, you know, for her. And she sort of sees men as human beings in general as kind of part of the problem. And so she uses the problem to fight itself in this kind of jujitsu of villainy. And communist characters like the Crimson Dynamo get rehabilitated into the Ivan Vanko of Iron Man 2, for example. If you remember that I Want My Bird, you know, that great version of the Whiplash from Iron Man 2. What was the name of the actor?
Oh crap. Now I can't think of it.
Who I'm talking about. He's a institution, that guy.
Yeah. He's in the Expendables too.
Yes, he has. Yes. He's been in all of those movies. Anyway, and now every one of our audience is all shouting his name at the screen.
It's true. Yep.
Anyway, he's now a guy who's motivated because his father was actually a victim of the communist system and thrown into Siberia in a gulag. And he was only motivated to go back to Russia because some American capitalist had betrayed him, you know? And so there's all of these rehabilitations that have gone on, and writers like Claremont were responsible for a lot of that, where you would see it happen every issue in the X-Men. It seemed like every issue of the X-Men, they would meet some foreigner who starts off a villain, but he's only a villain because the X-Men all jump him and shoot at him. And then eventually you find out that he's really just trying to protect his country from these crazy mutants. And Sunfire, in this particular example,
just going to say that
comes back around and he ends up joining So great writers are very aware of the problematic nature of these villains and have worked very hard to rehabilitate them. And so writing the Temptress and the Foreigner was the hardest part of the book for me, because I think we had to try to we had to both acknowledge the problems in superhero comics from less politically aware eras, and also give credit to later writers who have tried to turn it around. So that's probably where I'll go to when I get my physical copy and I go to look up and see how it turned out. That's probably where I'll start.
Excellent. Well, we're gonna put the link for the Kickstarter in the bottom of the show notes, and running a little bit long, but a lot of good information coming out. So there's nothing wrong with that. If people want to follow your work and track you down as your new best friend on FaceSpace or tweet out or whatever the social media that you use, what's a good place to find you?
So my blog, irregularly updated blog, is drcomics.blogspot.com. I'm on Facebook as Jason Tondreau. I can be found on YouTube. I teach a lot of online classes, and so all of my online lectures are all on YouTube. So I have a YouTube channel. So if you're cramming for a Shakespeare quiz, or you don't want to read the entirety of Milton's Paradise Lost and you want the short version, or you're starting to read the Dante's Inferno and you just need a hand, pull me up. It's you'll find me on YouTube as well under my name, Jason Tondreau, and I am on Twitter at Dr. Comics, all spelled out, DrComics. I am obliged to note, since it came out, there is another Dr. Comics. There's actually more than one, but the original Dr. Comics, whom I did not know about this, the original Dr. Comics is also a scholar of comics. He lives in Australia. He's a super nice guy. He's been in the field much longer than I have. We have collaborated and talked. We have decided that he is the Shazam Captain Marvel of Dr. Comics, and I am the Captain Marvel Captain Marvel of Dr. Comics. So we've decided to share the...
That's pretty awesome. I'm going
to... We want to do a team up. We want to do a Dr. Comics team up. Yeah.
Okay. Do you think he'd come on the podcast?
I don't know. He might. I mean, we chat on Twitter, so I certainly could certainly ask him. He teaches. He's a professor, and writes academically, and he's an editor on major comics journals. I'm sure he uses the name Dr. Comics when he does television and radio and media appearances in Australia. So. Yeah, we could probably get him on. Sure, yeah.
I think we should definitely track this guy down.
It'll be the crisis of comics. Okay.
Yep, that's awesome. Hey, thank you very much for coming out today and taking an hour of your time to talk about this stuff. I know it must be exhausting because, you know, you have to talk about this all day long with your students. But it's really been a treat for you to come out and talk about this different things and talk about the fact that apparently I got to brush up on my art style so we can have a fast lane comic.
Oh God, please, somebody help me make fast lane the series. it's 5.5 years. It's like, it's 66 issues, every state in the continental U.S. I don't know if I can get to Hawaii. I mean, there's got to be a highway that goes to Alaska. Does Highway 1 go all the way to Alaska? I don't know. But I totally, we got to write that book. And Smokey and the Bandit will totally be in there. And I am going to homage US-1, even if I have to file off all of the serial numbers. Somehow we will do that. There's so many things we could put in that book. Like, God, Knight Rider could show up. I Transformers could show up. Not to mention the supervillain that travels the country in the back of a tractor trailer rig. I mean, I want to put the guy from Duel in there. You know, that old Spielberg film. God, we could write that. We could write the shit out of that book.
Oh my God, this thing would write itself. That's crazy.
It would. It would write itself.
Oh my God. Well, thank you very much again for taking some time and talking about the Supervillain Handbook and your long career in comics and comic book role playing games. We really appreciate it. And I'm Walt. And what's that?
It's been a real pleasure.
Oh, thank you so much. Hey, the dog.
It's been a real pleasure. Thank you very much for having me. Yes, Miss Tessmacher. Right in the audience, Miss Tessmacher.
Awesome. And for Indie Creative Spotlight, we're out.